You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about stories from Holocaust survivors and what we can learn about the stigma surrounding sexual assault even these decades later. Now, expect to hear more in the months to come about who President Joe Biden wants to see serving on federal courts. Last week, he unveiled a list of 11 nominees of various ethnic backgrounds to serve as federal district or appeals court judges, including a potential U.S. Supreme Court candidate should Biden get the chance to appoint someone. Biden aides say another batch of nominees may be announced as soon as part of a steady drumbeat over the spring and the summer. We're talking about it now, and you can weigh in. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the direction of the federal judiciary? Has it become too conservative, or do you think it should be more conservative? How important is it to you that federal judges are made up of a wide range of backgrounds, or is judicial philosophy, what they say, priority number one? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Russ Feingold is a former Democratic U.S. senator from Wisconsin. He's now the president of the American Constitution Society. Senator Feingold, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be on. I'm actually on Central Time the whole last year in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Nice change. What are your overall thoughts on President Biden's nominees?
Well, at the American Constitution Society, we're excited because the whole idea for this organization was the realization that the federal courts were being captured by really ideological conservatives, often very young, in a way that was distorting the courts. And this list of 11 potential judges that President Biden has identified is exciting because it's diverse in terms of background, demographic background. There are African Americans, there are Latinx people and others. And in addition, there's some diversity in terms of the kind of lawyers these people have been. In other words, not just corporate lawyers or prosecutors, but there are four people on there who have been public defenders. So, you know, the point here that we believe in is if you go to court, you know, it's only fair that you should feel confident about who the judge is, and that sometimes the judge might look like you or the judge might be somebody who has represented your side of a case in the past and that kind of work. So this is crucial because under President Trump, things have gone very, very badly in terms of diversity. And the damage is going to be very long term. But this list from President Biden is the first major step in the right direction in a long time.
Do you think it's fair then to say that the idea here is to offset the conservative mark that former President Trump left on the federal judiciary?
You know, it's not just conservatism itself, which, you know, is perfectly legitimate. But in addition to most of these nominees being extremely conservative and very narrow in terms of their view of the law, partly because of the work of the Federalist Society, it's also a group of people that are really lack the diversity, lack the ability to really reflect the population of this country. So, for example, under President Trump, 76% of the people they put through were men, 84% were white, only one was Latinx, not a single one of the Court of Appeals judges was black. And so it's that's part of the problem. And also they were overwhelmingly people that had never represented plaintiffs in injury cases, people that had never represented criminal defendants, people that had never been, people that had worked in community activities of that kind. So we need to repair the federal judiciary in a number of ways. And things have gotten very seriously wrong, not just on the ideological ground.
President Trump won confirmation of more than 220 judges, including three Supreme Court justices. How big of a deal do you think that is?
Well, it's a big deal, and it's a very disturbing thing because it was done basically by breaking the rules. I was in the Senate, and I had never could have imagined the kind of thing that was done when Justice Scalia died. President Obama had won the election. Clearly, he had the right to fill that seat, and Mitch McConnell and the Senate refused to even give him a hearing. They stole that seat. And then they stole the seat when Justice Ginsburg died. Everybody knows that they did a rush job there right before the election. Instead of using the normal time that would be allowed to consider a judge, that should have been President Biden's nomination. And so they did the Supreme Court that way, and they systematically did everything they could to block every judge that President Obama had. So that's how they got the chance to do this, by breaking the rules and traditions of the Senate and the confirmation process. And so we're not recommending that Biden's people break these rules or the majority Democratic Senate break the rules. But the reality is that the only way to repair this is with judges retiring, taking senior status and filling the seats the best that can be done in the coming weeks, because this was really a very brutal and unfair process that hopefully would not be repeated again.
You take issue with both of those nominations to the Supreme Court you just laid out. So is there one answer? Because, first Republican majority chose to delay bringing on a Supreme Court justice, and then they moved quickly. You say that both were wrong. So what is the right situation there?
Well, I mean, in the case of Scalia, there was basically a whole year left. Yeah. There was no excuse for not getting that done in a deliberative way. President Obama made a nomination. There was plenty of time, and there had never been a delay anywhere near that long. The longest ever, I think, was like 126 days for Justice Brandeis. This was essentially a year. So there was no justification for that. And then, of course, completely cynically and hypocritically, they did the opposite. Suddenly, in the middle of, right before an election, Justice Ginsburg dies. And instead of saying, well, we really can't do this in an election year, they rammed it through in a few weeks. So the truth is that both of those things were stealing a Supreme Court seat. And I can tell you that I would not have believed that either of those would have been possible in the Senate that I knew, and frankly, the Senate that Mitch McConnell was in, where I can't even imagine him having done that in the past. So it shows how extreme things have become. And frankly, it's done great damage to the United States Senate and to the confirmation process.
We're talking with Russ Feingold, former Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. As he just said, he's now the president of the American Constitution Society, and we're having a discussion about the federal judges and what happens next in the Biden administration after the president has released a list of judicial nominees. What questions do you have about this process? What do you want to better understand? Maybe you have an idea about how President Biden should handle this moving forward. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Here's what White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters the day that Biden unveiled his list.
Look, I think there is an incredible group of nominees the president announced today. As someone who served for 17 years on the Senate Judiciary Committee as chairman and ranking member, he has a long history on judicial appointments. This is a priority for him. But our focus is on getting the Senate to confirm these group of nominees and to continue to build a pipeline of additional highly qualified nominees who are going to reflect the values the president has outlined.
So what are the values that you're looking for in these selections then? You heard what Jen Psaki says are the values of President Biden.
Our value about this, the American Constitution Society, is that when somebody goes into the courtroom, that they feel like they have a fair chance. Hmm. And that means the judge needs to be somebody who, at least in theory, on some occasions, looks like them, or somebody who has actually had the opportunity to represent that side of the case. In other words, if the person you go in front of has always worked at a corporate law firm and has never had the experience of representing somebody on the other side of a corporate case like that, it's questionable. If all they've ever done has been a prosecutor and represented the state as opposed to representing a criminal defendant, that's a problem. And, of course, this has become a huge issue in terms of African-American and other communities in our country with regard to policing and some of the practices that go on there. So our value is that it should feel like fairness, it should feel like justice, and the people that were nominated here really reflect that kind of background. As I said, four of these people actually have been public defenders. Many of them have gone on to become top-notch, lower-level federal judges and have done many other things, but at least they've had that experience of being on the other side, and the courts are way too tilted in one direction to be balanced.
Among Biden's 11 nominees is Ketanji Brown Jackson for the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia Circuit. She is one of three African-Americans on the list and currently a lower level federal judge. She's also considered a top candidate for the U.S. Supreme Court if Biden were to get the chance to appoint someone. What to you makes her worthy of consideration here?
Well, by all accounts, she's just terrific. We at the American Constitution Society are very high on her. We've had her involved with our programs over the years, and we know that not only are there too few women of color who serve on our circuit courts to begin with, but the word on her is that she really is an exceptional judge who would be a great Court of Appeals judge and possibly a Supreme Court justice. And as we know, there's a good chance that that Justice Breyer may decide to retire at some point when President Biden is in office. And President Biden did say during the campaign that he intended to place the first African-American woman on the Supreme Court. So this elevation for Judge Brown Jackson would be very exciting.
And talk a little bit more about the idea of representation as we talk about Judge Brown Jackson, because she is, a person who is nominated, who is a black judge, and how important it is that we have people who represent different genders and ethnicities as judges.
Well, it's crucial. And let me take an example from where we are in Wisconsin. So we're part of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana. And, you know, that's got about 15 judges on it. And in the past, they had a black judge. But at this point, there's not a single African-American judge on that court out of all those people. And, these are states that include Chicago and, Milwaukee, Indianapolis, Racine, Kenosha, Gary, Indiana, places that have significant African-American populations. And there's not a single person on that court right now who has that background. So the New York Times noticed this, and others have pointed out that this is an extreme example of where there really isn't the balance. And Trump put four new judges on there, none of them representing this solving this problem. And so we're pleased that Candace Jackson Akiwumi has been appointed potentially to become the first African-American judge on that court for some time.
We're talking about the makeup of the federal judiciary and President Biden's nominees for the bench with Russ Feingold. He's the president of the American Constitution Society and a former Democratic U.S. Senator. Your questions are welcome here on the Ideas Network. Email ideas at WPR.org. This conversation continues ahead on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking with former Democratic U.S. Senator Russ Feingold. He's now the president of the American Constitution Society, and we're looking at the federal judiciary. And we've got Matt and Madison ready to join the conversation. Hey, Matt.
Yeah, hi there. I just have a comment, an observation. As much as one could view the rushing of the recent appointment to fill Justice Ginsburg's spot as in indecent play, it was still within the rule book as far as it's written right now. And so I would think that political players will become more efficient at using the rules to their advantage. And so I think that a real emphasis needs to be put on sort of rewriting that algorithm to perhaps try to build in what we think is decent rules. In basketball, they used to sort of outlaw the dunk, or it was maybe looked upon as unethical. But then as everyone began dunking, it became part of the game. I think that far deep look at the algorithmic rule book is unnecessary.
Matt, thank you so much. And Senator Feingold, it sounds like, Matt might be talking not just about the judiciary, but more broadly, as a former member of the Senate, trying to decide what the rules are and being willing to honorably follow them.
That was really a good comment, an interesting comment. He's right. I mean, the way in which this has been handled in the past has been essentially an understanding of fairness that applied to Supreme Court and other nominations, and giving people the appropriate time or taking the appropriate time to do things right and not rushing things at the wrong time. But it wasn't formally written in detail in the rules. But I think he's right. It could be. You could put in the Senate rules, and this is something I've actually written about, you could put something in the Senate rules that establishes certain timeframes for nominations so that this kind of abuse can't happen. It's too bad we have to do this, but it's leads to the actual theft of the Supreme Court for a generation here because they're not specific timeframes in place. So I think that would make sense. Only the Senate can do it. The Senate is able under the Constitution to set its own rules. The court can't tell them how to do it. And so I think actually that was a very good comment, and it'd be one way to help solve the problem in the future.
Yeah. When we're dealing with judges, do you see any of Biden's nominees having trouble being confirmed by the Senate?
It's possible. I mean, look, if a decision is made by McConnell and the Republicans to try to block somebody completely, in other words, not really give the Republican senators the freedom to choose to vote for the nominee, then they'd have to have every single Democrat plus the vice president. So if any Democrat decides that one of these nominees is a problem, that can make it impossible, because this is such a close situation in the Senate. My guess is most of these people will be confirmed, but I'd be surprised if they don't put up a fight. And we have to make sure that these senators don't denigrate the important work that many of these people have done as public defenders and others. The issue here isn't just the individuals. It's the principle that judges should reflect a variety of legal backgrounds and experience and not just be from one side of the coin. So I'd be surprised if these go completely smoothly, but I'm hoping that as many as possible do.
Yeah, it requires teamwork, though, in Congress.
Well, yeah, and we don't have a lot of that right now. And, of course, the Senate is so divided and this judicial issue is so contentious that it is going to be a very important few weeks, and they're going to be starting the hearing soon in the Judiciary Committee. And then I know the Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, is going to want to move these as quick as possible. But, you know, it takes some time.
Yeah. Senator Feingold, thanks for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Russ Feingold is the president of the American Constitution Society and a former Democratic U.S. senator from Wisconsin. And we talked with him about President Biden's list of federal judicial nominees and why he says the bench needs more women and minority representation. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about leaving home and finding a new one.
There's a place in Ripon that's providing a space for musicians and artists to get as creative as they want to. At the Heist, organizers have converted a former bank into a community space that they hope will bring people together. Aisha Jaffer recently spent a weekend there and introduces us to the makers at the Heist.
Sam Luna is a musician, creator, and educator. He's traveled across the nation searching for his artistic home in places like New Mexico and L.A., with the goal of starting a project that amplifies a greater artist community.
I'd always wanted to be a part of an art project. You know, I really thought that talking about Wisconsin, I find myself more inspired here than most places I go to.
It was actually love that brought Luna to Wisconsin, but his passion for the creative community keeps him here. His first experience was in Kenosha, booking shows from music to spoken word. It's also where he found music.
I quit a job one day without even thinking about it. I had written one song and figured I would just try it. And that was 15 years ago, and that's where I started doing music and art.
Well, I've been on the road for 10 years now. Forgotten where I really want to go. Forgotten where I want to call home.
Sam's music took him all around the state, but when he was asked to play in Ripon, he had no idea his life was about to change.
So I took the road in, turned the corner, saw this building, and I got goosebumps. I saw the downtown, really beautiful community. There's only been, you know, three places that have made me feel that way in all the different travels.
Sam became fascinated with that building. A year later, he acquired what is now the art space known as the Heist. Before this, the building had taken on many forms as an opera house, venue, and a bank. Its time as a bank tied directly into a piece of Luna's family history and his grandmother.
She played music, some jazz music at night, rob banks during the day. She found herself in a situation where she thought the only way to provide for herself or her family was through robbing a bank. And here came an opportunity to be able to take a bank and give it back to the community.
I had the pleasure of spending the night at the Heist, and inspiration was radiating throughout its walls.
It's a place to create, inspire, educate, and collaborate. And using those in every bit of the arts, through food, through textiles, through music, through art, through community, a place to be able to come together, learn together, and inspire each other. That's really what I want people to come in and feel from the space.
During my stay, I was able to speak to some of the talent who are currently using the space, like musician Tay of Green Bay.
It makes it more colorful here. And I don't mean that like just in an artistic way. I think that the diversity that we bring in from different people from different cultures and just different mindsets, people aren't used to that here. And so I think that's like one of the most valuable parts.
While Tay rehearses with her band in the main lobby, I find Aaron Dusterheff in another part of the building called the Hideout. He's the resident audio engineer and recording Tay from one level above us.
I've met so many people doing this project that I would never have. I've dabbled in art the way I never have. It brings people together in a really intangible way, I guess.
During this pandemic, Luna says the Heist continues to support and highlight the artist community all throughout Wisconsin.
Musicians, artists, sound engineers, lighting crew. There are so many different people that are affected with this shutdown, that are involved with the arts. And remember that each individual person is a small business. And so let's find ways to come together to help those small businesses. And I think that's what the goal of this space is to do, is try and gather people together and help, even if it's to bring awareness.
That story on the Heist in Ripon came to us from Aisha Jaffer, a storyteller based in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Coming up, we talk to an expert who researches how trauma impacts how we recount events and sometimes can change our account over time. We're discussing what we can learn from past experiences about the stigmas that we have regarding assault today. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce is suing the DNR for testing industrial sites for toxic PFAS chemicals. Find out more about the case and the state's work to make enforceable pollution standards ahead. Now, the next conversation is a discussion about sexual assault and violence. The Me Too movement has empowered survivors of sexual assault to speak up, and some of them tell different stories over time. Our next guest says we can learn why by looking back to the Holocaust. I spoke with Allison Sarah Reeves-Simoji after she published an article about her findings. Allison has a PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's now a fellow at the university, and she examines how women handled sexual violence during the Holocaust. Here's our conversation with Allison starting us off.
Jewish women would constantly talk about how when the Soviet soldiers liberated Hungary, they were raping women. And they would constantly say, thank God it didn't happen to me. It happened to everybody, but it was so lucky that it didn't happen to me. But everybody said that. So I noticed that that's statistically impossible.
Right, because you write, in Budapest alone, Soviet soldiers raped an estimated 50,000 women. So if you have accounts from so many women and all of them say it happened to everybody, but thank goodness it didn't happen to me, like there's got to be something that's off there.
Right. And of course, I'm only working with Hungarian Jewish women. There isn't actually data on specifically Hungarian Jewish women, but they spoke so much about how this was happening to their fellow Hungarian Jewish women, to fellow Hungarian women. It wasn't just Soviet soldiers that were raping women. This also happened with American soldiers, German soldiers, French, British. But Soviet soldiers were notorious for this after the war. It was sort of seen as an act of revenge, and they especially went after German women. That's very well known and very well documented. But what's less well documented was, of course, that this was happening amongst other Allied soldiers as well.
Jews after the war reclaim some things, but leave sexual assault kind of in that area of things they weren't comfortable talking about or admitting.
Well, it took decades for Jews to come around to being comfortable speaking about their experiences during the Holocaust. There were always survivors who were wanting and willing to talk about their experiences. And I noticed in the earlier testimonies, survivors talked about how people do not want to hear about their experiences, but they still were, for the most part, not willing to talk about their own experiences of sexual violence. And I think that just has to do with the broader stigma about and shame attached to sexual violence that hasn't changed. And I don't know if it's a generational thing as we move farther and farther away from the Holocaust, if it is because a newer generation is feeling less responsible, less guilty for it. I know that there has been a dramatic shift in the way that the public has responded to Holocaust survivors and hearing their stories.
That we're more open to it now?
Definitely.
One example that you give is a woman who was a Holocaust survivor talking about sexual assault in 1980 and then again telling her story in 1994. What did you find when she was talking about sexual assault with an interviewer in 1980?
So she was talking about when she was in a ghetto in Hungary before she was sent to a concentration camp, that she was chosen to work for a Hungarian military captain in this ghetto. And she was talking about how she was working there and she personally was not a victim of rape, but that he was bringing girls in and raping them. And she was trying to tell the story and she was getting very upset. She was crying and she was cut off by the interviewer. She cut her off to say that this ghetto was not actually really a ghetto, was it? And she had been crying and she was very upset. And it was just really shocking that she would interrupt her at this time when she was telling such an emotional story about how this Hungarian military captain was raping all these Jewish women. The survivor actually, she insisted, no, this absolutely was a ghetto, and she was really insulted, you could tell, but she even made an effort to say, I want to bring this back to this captain that I'm talking about and try to finish the story that she was telling. But I noticed that when she gave her testimony again in the mid-90s, she spoke about this Hungarian military captain, but she said that he was a bad man, but she didn't mention anything about the rapes. And I don't know why that was the case, but I saw her get shut down. And I don't know if it was because she had learned from that experience that it was something that the interviewer had really not wanted to hear about. But that was a hypothesis that I had.
It really sounds like, from your perspective, we've made a lot of progress in the last 75 years to be able to talk more about the Holocaust, to be open to hearing stories about people's experiences there, except we haven't made much progress when it comes to accepting and listening to people who've been raped.
It feels like we've made progress. I mean, this Me Too movement felt like some big seismic change, and then I think that women are aware that some things are just not acceptable to speak about. There is definitely a message that is being sent to women that you have to be careful what you say, how you say it, when you say it. I think that it has a chilling effect, I think.
From your research, what should we consider when people today step forward and they talk about their trauma, their survival of rape or other sexual violence?
I don't want people to not believe women when these sorts of things happen, because there are real reasons why women change their stories, because there's a lot of societal pressure for women to not speak up about their experiences. At one point, these traumas about the Holocaust, surrounding the Holocaust experiences, were once considered to be very shameful. Why would Jews allow this to happen to them? That was the attitude. Like, why would any Jew allow themselves to be persecuted? Why would any Jew allow themselves to be put in a ghetto? Why would any Jew allow themselves to be sent to a concentration camp? Why would they not fight back? It was really an unfair attitude for people who had not experienced what Holocaust survivors had experienced. And that attitude finally changed after many decades, and people understood we can't judge how they reacted. We've come to understand that their victimization is not shameful, but somehow there's so much shame still attached to any sort of sexualized violence, and so much blame. That hasn't changed, and that is very sad. And what can be done about that? I don't have an answer, but certainly we can talk about it more.
Allison, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Allison Sarah Reeves-Somogyi. I spoke with her after she published an article in The Conversation about her research at the University of North Carolina. She studies how women handled sexual violence during the Holocaust and what that tells us today. You can read her article by visiting our website, WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, the state's largest business lobby is suing the DNR over the sampling it's doing for toxic PFAS chemicals, also known as forever chemicals. We find out more from a WPR reporter. That's next here on Central Time. For millions of adopted Americans, state law can prevent them from knowing where they came from. Depending on where you live, information about your birth parents is kept under lock and key. NPR's Steve Inskeep shares his own story and talks with Jen White about the push to change a system that robs so many of their identities. That is ahead on 1A Plus. It starts at 6 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. The state's largest business lobby, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, is suing the Department of Natural Resources over its sampling of PFAS at industrial and wastewater treatment plants. It's the second lawsuit the group has filed against the DNR this year over its authority to test for PFAS. The chemicals found in firefighting foam and some consumer products have been linked to certain cancers, thyroid disease, and reproductive problems. They've been found at more than 50 sites around Wisconsin. But the state is still developing official standards for what level of contamination is unsafe. Daniel Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked earlier with Central Time producer Dean Kinetter.
Let's start with this most recent lawsuit from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. What case are they making against the DNR in this complaint?
Yeah, so in this case that they filed just recently, they're saying that the agency is unlawfully seeking to sample wastewater for PFAS that's released from industrial and municipal facilities. And these are facilities that are operating under wastewater discharge permits. And so they're saying that the DNR lacks outright authority to conduct the sampling, although the agency has stated that they've disagreed with that perspective, that they believe that under state law and rules governing these permits, that they are able to go in and do this type of work.
And what is the actual purpose of this sampling that the DNR is doing?
Yeah, so the DNR said in a statement that they're doing the sampling because they are trying to gather information as they're working to develop standards right now for PFAS in surface water. And if you remember, you know, the DNR launched the rulemaking process last year after the Natural Resources Board approved creating standards for two of the most common PFAS chemicals, PFOA and PFOS. And so they're working on standards right now for those chemicals in drinking water, surface water, and groundwater. And this, according to Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, is part of an effort to gauge the economic impact of implementing those standards.
So the DNR is doing the sampling in part to develop those standards, but they don't have them yet. Is that part of the reason why WMC is saying they don't have the authority to do the testing in the first place?
Yeah, that is one part of their contention. They're saying, you know, first off, that these chemicals are not even yet regulated under state law, but that having these samples available, that these facilities would risk being stigmatized as polluters, even though they're not required to sample for them currently under the law. That's really frustrated environmental groups and community members and areas where this contamination has been found, because they have said that basically that this business lobbying group has obstructed the process, that they've kind of stood in the way of even developing these standards, and now are trying to actively keep the DNR from collecting this information, which could be used to get a better handle on the scope of contamination and possibly get communities help that they need, where we've seen, you know, communities in the La Crosse area, for example, with French Island, who have now been offered bottled water because their private wells on French Island are contaminated. And so it's a growing issue across the state.
And now that this lawsuit has been filed, I believe in Jefferson County, where does that leave the DNR's work? Is this testing on hold now?
Yeah. So, you know, on, what was it, March 29th? It was Monday. A judge issued a restraining order to bar the DNR from conducting the sampling and from releasing this data to the public. But then there was a hearing on Thursday, and the judge moved to restrict that restraining order to just the release of information. So now the DNR is able to resume the sampling, but another hearing is set in the matter for April 12th.
We're talking with Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, looking at a lawsuit from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce against the DNR over PFAS testing. And Danny, this lawsuit covers both private industry and wastewater treatment plants. And those treatment plants in particular seem to have had a bit of an evolution on the issue. Can you talk about their stance on that PFAS testing over the past couple of years?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, a couple of years ago, the DNR asked, I think it was 125 wastewater treatment plants to voluntarily conduct this sampling themselves to get samples of PFAS from wastewater. But the vast majority of those plants declined to test their wastewater for the chemicals. And in fact, several groups who represent wastewater system operators in the state advised their members not to test for them. And they did that because they pointed to the lack of state standards. And also at that time, there was no sampling protocols that were in place. Labs hadn't yet been certified to test for PFAS. But now some of these groups are saying, you know, they have a lot more information. You know, those protocols are in place now. Labs have been certified, and they feel more confident about gathering this data as a way to at least start to address the problem and try and identify where this contamination is happening and reduce that at the source to prevent it from entering their systems.
And there is guidance from the state and the federal government in terms of how much PFAS contamination could be dangerous. But as you mentioned, we don't have those enforceable standards yet. Do you have a sense of like the timeline on when that might, when those rules might be developed and put in place?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So, you know, the state has been working on developing their own regulations for these chemicals because there's a lack of federal standards for PFAS right now. You know, they have really not started that process at all under the Trump administration. They were saying that they were going to get going on that under the EPA, but They haven't really launched it yet, and that's going to take years to develop once they do kick it off. So the state has been taking these steps on their own, but yet, even though they've already launched their process, it could still take another year to complete. And there's also, like you said, there's difference in what's considered safe. You know, we've seen states come out like Wisconsin with a recommended groundwater standard of 20 parts per trillion, which is far below the health advisory that the EPA has set of 70 parts per trillion. And so I think the uncertainty is one reason that industry is bucking on this. And it's, you know, in the past, they've argued that, you know, having a patchwork of regulations is never really good for giving business certainty in their operations.
And according to the DNR, there's been PFAS contamination at more than 50 sites in Wisconsin. You mentioned that very recently, French Island near La Crosse is dealing with this. Can you talk a bit more about how the state is responding to the situation there?
Yeah, so very recently, the state issued a water advisory for thousands of French Island residents over concerns stemming from PFAS contamination there. That contamination is the result of firefighting foam that was used at the La Crosse Regional Airport. And that was used by the fire department as part of testing and also response to some fires at the site over the years. And so now it's been identified in the soil and groundwater on the airport's property, and it's been moving and contaminating some wells on the island. And because they don't have a really good idea of the extent of that contamination, they've offered bottled water to, again, thousands of residents, and they're continuing to collect sampling to kind of get a better handle on this. And also at the same time, you know, La Crosse's mayor, Tim Cabot, has come out and said that they need more help, that, you know, they've been doing the best they can with the situation, but because the scope of it is growing, they're looking for more state guidance and for the state to step in and kind of identify other sources of contamination related to this.
So the state is still working on developing these standards, as we've been talking about. But for people who might have this in their well or be getting bottled water, this is a pretty urgent issue. And it sounds like you've heard from some people and some groups that say, hey, standards or not, we should be testing for this and letting the public know what we find.
Yeah, absolutely. Like groups like Clean Wisconsin, the Sierra Club, and community members in areas like Marinette and Peshtigo have said, you know, we really can't afford to wait to do this type of testing. They think that just having an idea of what's there, even if there's disagreement over what's considered safe or not safe, at least gives you an idea of where the contamination exists and whether or not steps should be taken to address that and get people some help. Because otherwise, if you're not testing for it, then potentially people are living in areas where they may be exposed to potentially harmful levels of these chemicals and they have no idea. And so they feel like some information is better than nothing at all.
And Danny, as we wrap up, there's a lot going on with this issue right now between the lawsuit we've been talking about and the standards being created. What do you have your eye on next when it comes to PFAS around the state?
Well, I mean, obviously this case with WMC is going to be going on for who knows how long. I mean, we'll see what happens at the hearing on April 12th and also in their other case in Waukesha County. There's also been discussion about PFAS in the state budget. And Governor Tony Evers has proposed creating a municipal grant program that would provide $10 million to local governments to address PFAS contamination in their communities. And that would be $10 million in each year of the budget. But it's really uncertain whether or not, you know, some of his proposals will make it through the budget writing process and working with the Joint Finance Committee and the Republican-controlled legislature on that. So I guess we'll see what happens in those discussions.
We will leave it there for now. But Danny, thanks for getting us up to speed.
Thank you so much for having me.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked with Central Time producer Dean Kinetter about the latest lawsuit from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce against the Wisconsin DNR over the issue of forever chemical testing, that's PFAS testing. You can follow the developments in that case and find coverage of ongoing pollution issues around the state at WPR.org.